Richard Kinsersley is going to be speaking on the National Armed Forces Memorial, Staffordshire.
Richard, thank you.
Thank you. This is an extraordinary project which I've been working on for the last 2 years. It's a memorial to service personnel who've been killed since 1945. When I first started this job, I was shocked to hear that the memorial will commemorate 16,500 names. Because we've been involved in many small wars since 1945. Counterinsurgency in places like Borneo and Singapore, the Korean War, but also to extradite ourselves from our colonial past, which was not always, but sometimes a fairly bloody retreat. So that is why we've lost so many people since 1945. This memorial was planned about 5 years ago as an open competition, and it was won by a young English architect who had great interest in classicism. And what you see here is the memorial during the process of building. It's going to be finished in October of this year, and it consists of two giant curved outer walls which is something like 7 meters tall, containing two inner walls of 4 meters tall. And I'll show you here the architect's drawing. You can see the outer curved walls and the two straight inner walls. And these are to be covered in lettering, covered in the names of the people who have lost their lives. And you can see here the extraordinary sort of scope of the number of names. When I was first approached for this work, I was asked whether it could be carved by hand. But I worked out it would take 5 people 10 years to carve this. So that makes it completely impossible, particularly with modern construction programs, which are, because of the cost of everything, are speeded up. So these projects, which even 30 years ago would have taken 10 or 15 years, are now built in 3 or 4 years. Also, there's an extraordinary sort of sense of people's vanity, that the people who sort of start these projects actually want to get them finished before they retire, so they can be part of the celebration of the completion. So, confronted with this problem of it taking 10 years to do by hand, I was asked to consider alternative methods. And really there are only two. One is to sandblast the letters, and the other is to have them routed. Sandblasting is a very crude system. It's basically two-dimensional, and there have been some very poor results with large memorials in London recently. So I suggested routing, and at the same time, an Italian machine manufacturer called OMAG had developed the very latest form of routing machine. And I went to see them, and we found a way forward in which I could design a font using their new machine. And what I wanted to do was produce a letter form which had some of the characteristics of carved lettering, because most machine lettering looks very dead and cold and flat. Now, I know Ken Garland was rather grumpy about this morning. But this is the real thing, or it's a glimpse of the real thing, because sadly it is incredibly weathered. Most of it done in the last 50, 60 years. Two things. One is acid rain from traffic pollution, the pollution going up and then it raining and then it comes down as acid rain. And that is a very effective way of dissolving marble. That's one reason why a lot of the definition has been lost. The other, believe it or not, was in the 60s, the Italians cleaned the whole inscription down with acid. So what we see here is a very faint impression of what it was. But nonetheless, you can still see the vigour of the penmanship when the ordinator originally set the letters out. This is a letter on the Via Appia, on a fragment, and it is the most exquisite demonstration of hand and eye. You can just almost feel, can't you, physically, the sense of the brush forming that bowl. It's just exquisite. This is the other greater inscription in Rome, also on the Via Appia. It's much better preserved than the Trajan inscription. The letters are smaller, and yet they're very clear. You can see the serifs strongly drawn in. Beautiful S. The interesting difference is the A's and the N's have flat tops to them. Then, as you can see in the middle, on the far left and the far right, the A with that angled flat top. So come back to my project for the Armed Forces Memorial. The lettering had to fit into a very, very tight specification. Because of the number of names, we could only carve at 25 millimetres, which for a limestone is very, very small. And these were some early test cuttings by hand. And to give you an idea, those letters are cut at 25 millimetres, but the larger letters, the R and the E, are much larger, and of course you don't have any conflict with the granular quality of the stone. So the letters are very sharp, the arises are sharp, the serifs are sharp. But if you go back to the very small 25 millimetre letter, you can see the problem of the texture, the granules of the stone starting to show through. The other thing about working with a machine is, although it's incredibly accurate, it is also incredibly dumb. So you have to tell it everything. So we went on carving our hand interpretations till we got that right, and then we had to make all these cross-section drawings to show the machine the depth of the thick strokes, the thin strokes, and also the serifs. Once we had established all the depths, then we started to draw the font, which we drew, and remember that all this had to be done within a year. That means designing the font, digitizing, and getting the inscription cut. So everything was very rough. We started by drawing the letters, and then digitizing into FontLab. And here you can see the finished font. So these letters are, as I said before, specifically designed to work at 25 millimetres, very small lettering stone. So your thins had to be proportionally thicker. And the serifs had to be also quite strong. You can see that we've done away with the centre serif on the E and the F. But to try and introduce some sparkle into these letters, these serried rows of names, I added small little devices, like if you can see on the U, V, W, X and Y, there's a one-way serif, it just curls over. And also on the letter N, the same device. Here you can see a very early spacing test. As you can see, it's not right. We had to cheat quite a bit because we were running out of time, so we used a lot of sort of kerning shorthands to get the spacing right. Now again, just another illustration of one of these curved walls, completely covered from top to bottom with names. This is a slide of the OMAG machine. It works incredibly fast, and it was working for us 24 hours a day cutting these panels. And because the router blade was rotating at such high speed, it had to be drenched with water to keep it cool. The accuracy of this machine was stunning. As I say, it's a five-axis router. So if you feed it with software for a Corinthian capital, it'll carve that. If you feed it software for an architectural moulding, it'll produce that. So the lettering is just another thing it makes. It's nothing special. But the accuracy is extraordinary. It has the router blade has a sort of home base on the machining pad, which is about 3 meters away from where it works. And when I was doing some early tests with the machine, it cut a name for me and then lifted up and went back to its home base. And the stone was cleaned off, and I had a look at the cerics, and they weren't quite deep enough for me. So the software was reprogrammed, and the start button was pressed, and this router head trundled 3.5 meters across from the edge and dropped down exactly into a 25-millimeter letter and recut all the cerics. What you see here are some early cutting tests using the machine. Because it was Italian, the first tests we did were all done in Milan, in Italy. And of course, they used the local material, which was marble. So they were quite stunningly beautiful and sharp. These ones here are done in Ireland, where the machine was based. And you can see they are very, very sharp. The whole project was divided up into stone panels, which are approximately a metre tall and about half a metre wide, slightly less. And we set out all the names in Quark. We did a certain amount of hand spacing afterwards. And you can see the convention was used as mostly in modern memorials, that there's no rank put. Just the name, initials, and decoration. It's thought, probably quite rightly, that we're all equal in death. This is a bottom panel, and you can see the 187 at the bottom identifies the column. So when relatives or people who have been killed come along, they can identify the column where their name is recorded. Of course, with all these things, the Quark is not compatible with the software for the OMAC machine. So this had to be saved as an EPS and made into an Illustrator file, which then contained font. And that was then emailed off to Northern Ireland, where the machine was done. The extraordinary process, the stone was quarried in the south of England, shipped to Ireland, machined, and then brought back to the UK for construction. One of the things which everybody's most concerned about were spelling mistakes. And the Armed Forces Trust checked incredibly carefully on spelling all the names, and then we did all our work. When we finished our work, we sent this paper document back to the Trust for checking. And they would sign it off, as it were. And you can see the little signing off label at the bottom. And you can see here, again, the massive letters. The large letters at the top have been hand-carved by my studio. And here's another detail. Some of the letters are rather unclear because they've still got cement in them from the fixing, which will be eventually cleaned off. The panels were broken down into the various forces, the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army. And I used the italic form simply to identify the various forces. And here's a bottom panel with the number engraved on the bottom as well. Another device which has been used in the memorial to make a very special event on Armistice Day. and that is on the inner straight wall and on the outer curved wall facing south, a 200 millimeter slot was left in the wall. So on the 11th day, sorry, at 11 o'clock, on the 11th day, on the 11th month, exactly that time, the sun shines through these slots, right through to the centre of the memorial. And we were commissioned to carve inscriptions by hand within these slots. And they had to be carved before both walls were completed, because there wouldn't be room to squeeze in there and carve it. And the wording here is, through this space a shaft of sunlight falls. At the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month. So that'll be quite a dramatic event. It'll be this November that it'll first be tested. So there'll be some very worried engineers around on that day. Yeah. This is a detail of the lettering cut within in the slots. Well, that's cut by hand. So now another shot of the machine lettering and the hand carved lettering above. And this is my team working, and we're completely covered in the various health and safety stuff you have to wear today. Glasses, hat, hard hat, high vis, jacket, etc. But two other things we were told we had to wear. One was gloves, and the other was earplugs, because of the sort of noise of machinery on a building site. Now, they're the two things which, when you're letter cutting, you can't wear. Because when you're working with your hands, you're using all your senses. I guess it's obvious to most of you that the sense of touch is important, so how you hold your chisel and the hammer, that you need that closeness with the tool. If you're wearing industrial gloves, you completely lose that. The other interesting thing are earplugs, because when you're carving stone, you listen also to the sound of the tapping. And the first warning you have of a bad piece of stone which might chip, might break away, is where you hear a different sound coming back from the stone. So these, a lot of these health and safety regulations are not written for people working with traditional crafts. As you can see, we're not wearing gloves, and you can probably just about see there's no air plug there. We told the site manager, and he just said, well, look, if we get a government inspector around, we just wear these things that day. The hand carving was very deep. When you're working in our sort of northern climate, in our very soft stones, as opposed to the traditional classical Italian griffins, we have to carve very, very deep, partly because we need the extra shadow, and also because of the weathering characteristics of our much softer stones. What I wanted just towards the end, just explore with you. And I always felt a slight sort of guilty feeling about designing and working with a machine font. But I'm going to share with you the sort of central difference between something which is made by hand and something which is produced by machine. This is an inscription. Actually, it's one of the most popular inscriptions I've ever carved. I must have done it about 10 times. It's a African traditional oral wording which I discovered from Kenya. Treat the earth well. It was not given to you by your parents. It was loaned to you by your children. It's quite a powerful statement, and it's got that nice sort of kick in the second two lines. But this has been laid out on a random rough piece of stone. There are no straight lines, and the thing is very sort of direct onto the stone. And it's something which you normally identify with handwork. It's slightly loose, as is this piece here. This is a large slab of stone, again with a random surface, and the inscription just laid onto it as an additional surface of texture. And this draws people into hand lettering, which has characteristics, as a lot of people imagine, it's to do with everything not being quite right. Everything not being quite straight, everything not quite being exact. And I think this is a wrong way to look at hand lettering. The first thing about it is, if you have a simple plaque like this, you have many, many letters of the same type. There are lots of E's, lots of O's, lots of S's. And unlike type, every single letter is slightly different. But I believe that the quality of really good lettering is the effort that the craftsperson makes in trying to produce that letter at the moment. It's rather like that letter D I showed you from the Via Appia. You can almost pick up the sort of electric quality of the hand flowing around the stone. And I think that's a great lesson to us all, that when we make something by hand, we somehow energize the thing we're making with that act of creation. And you can see here that the top line has got, the top two lines have got six E's, and they're all different. And with the Trajan font underneath, all the E's are identical. They're, as it were, like photographs repeated of one E. So what I think makes the very best handmade lettering attractive is not that it's got lots of little differences and oddities about it. It's a record of somebody making an effort to produce something as best as they can. And this quality, of course, you see in many ways. You sometimes see it in music, and somebody plays a piece particularly well. Or sometimes as a theatrical experience, when you see an actor delivering lines in a very sort of powerful way, there's an electricity there. And it's odd in our sort of world today that people working with their hands are probably more busy than they've ever been before, because there's a great desire to own and to touch and to feel and to look at things that are made by hand. It's a counterpoint to all the things we normally experience, which are machine-made or computer-designed. It's almost as if we all have a need or a hunger to touch something which records human creativity. So, thank you very much. I don't know if there are any questions.
Yeah.
Very interesting and pertinent question. One school of thought was we should go right up to Armistice Day on the 11th of November, just adding names. Sadly, with our involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan, there are a lot of names coming through now, and that was considered impractical, so we've got a cut-off date of 2006, and then every year names will be added on a yearly basis. And interestingly enough, they will all have to be hand-cut, because there's no way you can bring a huge machine on the site. So in a sense, you will be having craftspeople there emulating a machine-made letter that's gone full circle. Yes?
How much space did you spend for names?
Pardon?
How much space was left for new names?
There's about a quarter left.
Well, by that time there will be no more wars anyway.
Well, what was the stone? Did you mention it?
It's Portland.
Portland.
Mm. There's a whole sort of quarry full of stone in that monument. It's huge.
A totally prosaic question. Because of the speed you had to work at, you
idea how long it took, or how they did the 75,000 names?
No, where is that?
Belgium.
Oh, yes. I believe that was cut by hand, but I'm not absolutely sure.
That must have taken years.
Yes. That was Lutyens, is that one?
Yes.
I mean, you know, what's interesting is this time scale for these monuments to be built has been so compressed for the reasons I've given. This monument here, the first thing they had to do was construct a mound.
Yeah.
And normally you would leave a mound for 2 years to settle. Because there wasn't time left, it means they had to drive piles through, you know, 30 metres of earth to the ground underneath to support it all, because they couldn't wait for 2 years for the mound to settle.
Relating to that last question, really, the work of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission that was set up in 1916, the Great War finished in 1938, and then started.
Just in
time for the new one. We're hoping that organisation will take over the subsequent cutting on the list memorial. I mean, I think everybody argues that little gravestone that was designed is a very good piece of simple industrial design. And when you see these stones today in churchyards, you're still drawn to a sort of simplicity and their almost nobleness. Yeah.
This is another question about the content rather than the craft. But what was the reason for only giving initials?
Because it was felt that when these men died, in death they were all equal.
But they're not identified fully.
Well, they are identified with their name and initial.
My point was that initials only are not an identification, not your full name.
Yes, but they've got their full name, surname.
But the surname isn't.
Okay.
I wouldn't consider that to be a full name. And somebody coming along later, 100 years from now, wouldn't know what the first name was.
Yes. I guess that was to do with space. There's some very long names, even without having the first names. Okay, thank you.